Today's program has been brought to you by Brooklyn Slate Company, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. For more information, visit www.brooklynslate.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste, a conversation that is all too often forgotten, I think, although increasingly I'm getting books and I'm getting articles about the value of the taste of food, I think, beyond just pleasure, which of course taste is always a part of, but also a sort of cultural imperative to understand and enjoy and interact with the world around us. And today, I'm very excited to have with me a guest who is part of a renaissance of certain tastes in some ways. Noah Burnimoff is the owner, along with his wife Ray, of Mile End Delicatessen in Brooklyn and the Mile End Sandwich Shop in Manhattan. And thank you for being with us in Bushwick. And over the last few months together and separately, we have been part of a public discourse, I would say. I mean, many conversations and panels and presentations about a resurgence in interest in Jewish food and Jewish tastes. And you're right in the center of that in some ways. And I thought we would just start talking about what that moment is now, why you think now, and beyond just Mile End, which is a fascinating story and something we'll address specifically. What's going on out here in New York City and Brooklyn and Manhattan and in people's minds and mouths when it comes to Jewish food?
Thanks for having me on, Mitchell. Well, I think people are getting in touch with their ethnic roots. We've seen that, pretty richly with a lot of Italian Americans, a lot of Chinese Americans, a lot of Japanese Americans, and I think finally Jews are starting to come around to the idea that they also have their own, ethnic tastes to the food, the traditions of eating the food with your family. Those are starting to, I think, become very, very relevant to young Jews. And so I think what we're seeing is a set of Jews, a group of Jews in New York that are seeking familiar tastes, seeking familiar flavors. And for me personally, that was definitely the impetus to open Mile End, was my longing for familiarity and comfort. And I felt that what I had lost in the passing of my grandmother, who was sort of this grand balabusta cooking, she wasn't Eastern European, but she came from that same school of classic Ashkenazi woman
salty
in the home
food.
Yeah, salty, fatty, schmaltzy food. And I realized that with her passing, my family, me included, lost a large part of what it meant for us to be a family. And it was those sort of flavors of her home and those Friday night dinners and those gatherings for the Jewish holidays that really made me, the lack of them, the absence of them, really made me long for those, those experiences.
So that absence, I think, is something fascinating, because I happen to have written a Jewish cookbook in 2002, and at that time in New York, which everyone thinks of and is in reality the center of a certain Jewish life globally, it was almost impossible to find those flavors, those foods in any place you would want to take a guest, let's say. I mean, obviously you could go to Katz's and you could have a sandwich and remember those things. But, I remember trying to plan a sort of special Friday night dinner, and there was no restaurant to go to even to imagine, remember those flavors unless you cooked it yourself. So that absence, I think, is part of the thrill right now. Not just your personal family absence, but culturally, there things disappeared. Any insight into what went on there?
Well, I think through the development, you know, through my generation, the millennial generation's kind of upbringing development, I think my parents sort of pushed us. Not necessarily pushed us away from Jewish food, but it just, you know, I think American culture, Canadian, North American culture, we should say, because we're both Canadian, I should add.
I was born here, but grew up in Toronto, and you're from Montreal.
But North American culture began to, you know, not, you know, to consider salty, fattening foods, you know, bad for you. And they're right, you know, they are not particularly good for you. In moderation, of course, anything is fine, I guess.
Right.
I guess that's my own personal philosophy. But, you know, so I think that culturally, as North Americans, we were told that this is not the kind of food we should eat. So when you actually visit some of the old delis that have kind of, you know, that were established 50, 60, 70 years ago and have lived through this cultural shift in how North Americans eat, you know, you go to those delis and you see kind of weird stuff on those menus that are not remnants of the original thought of that deli, but rather remnants of like the 80s and 90s where delis started serving, you know, leafy green salads that really have absolutely nothing to do with deli. And I think that it was that turn towards trying to be more healthy that I think really pushed Jewish cooking and Jewish food out of, you know, kind of the stage, you know, the center stage for Jews particularly. And, you know, and I think a lot of, you know, particularly in New York, Jews moved out of the city back in the 60s and 70s, and suburban Jews just didn't take up some of the old establishments, institutions, when they moved to Roslyn, New York, or up to Westchester, or whatever. They left behind Sammy's Romanian, they left behind Ratner's, they left behind, you know, a lot of the institutions that they'd grown up on, and they didn't reestablish them. So essentially, you know, they were losing, you know, in their gentrification, suburbanization, they decided that they, you know, that the foods of our tradition were foods of the Lower East Side, particularly, and they should remain with the kind of the death of the pushcart.
Right. And so the children of those people, or even grandchildren of those people, longing for these flavors, these memories, as you said, could learn to cook or could open restaurants, and you opened Mile End in Brooklyn with Ray. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came to be? I mean, longing for a flavor and opening a restaurant are there's a lot in between those two things.
Sure. Yeah. I think, you know, ultimately the longing was what piqued my curiosity. It was my total dissatisfaction and unhappiness in law school that kind of redirected my focus away from becoming a lawyer and to a love that I had, I guess, more recently established, which was my love of food and my love of restaurants. I'm ultimately pretty young. My family growing up was not particularly outgoing in terms of restaurant culture in Montreal. That wasn't something, you know, there weren't foodies growing up, especially in Montreal. But Ray's family was very, being a New York family, they were very oriented toward eating food at restaurants. And so when Ray and I met back at McGill, we, you know, spent a lot of time going to restaurants with her. And so it was in doing that that I kind of, you know, realized that I had a particular interest in restaurants, in particular, design of restaurants, menu design. The food itself obviously had to work, but I felt I was very observant about things that I didn't like about a lot of restaurants, and I felt opening Mile End, doing the food that made sense to me, was a way for me to kind of seek that creative outlet that that law school really couldn't provide.
I'm going to remind people before I take off on that point that you can call us with questions if you have any about Montreal smoked meat, about running a delicatessen, about all sorts of things at 718-497-2128, or you can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.com. You can also tweet us. Perhaps you're listening to the podcast, as many people do, at Taste Matters HRN. So the traditional trajectory, I think, is that an immigrant family or a Jewish family opened a restaurant and saved all their money to put their kids into law school. And here you are going from law school into the restaurant business. I'm just curious, how was that received?
It was. People were confused. My family was confused as to why I wasn't going to at least finish law school.
Right.
They felt like, you know, I've already put 2 years in. Why am I kind of cutting myself short at 2/3 of the way through?
Interesting.
But I made the argument to them that law school, becoming a lawyer, doesn't end at your, you know, graduation from law school. There's studying for the bar. There's working for many years before you can actually bring in your own clients. And I knew that that wasn't going to be the path for me. I knew that at some point along the way, I was going to sort of quit no matter what stage I was in.
Right.
And so I figured, let's quit.
Cut our losses.
Let's cut our losses, right. Quit early on, and redirect our focus. So right. My parents have always been extremely supportive. They've always, you know, expressed to me that being happy and loving one another is the most important thing. Uh-huh. And so, you know, they received it, I guess, relatively well. But I will add that my grandfather survived my grandmother, who we mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. in the show. And I couldn't bring myself to tell him about my decision.
Interesting.
And he's since passed away. But those first few months when I made the decision, we actually started working on the restaurant. I basically kept it a secret from him. And it was only when that... a few months after we opened, there was an article that ran in the New York Times about, you know, whether there's a resurgence in Delhi. And we were one of the delis that were highlighted in it. And of course, my cousins in Florida, who didn't know about my little secretive plan, mailed a copy of the New York Times to my grandfather. And sure enough, you know, I got a phone call from him, and it was, you know, it was a little tough at the beginning, but ultimately he supported it. But I think that I needed him to be looking at an article in the New York Times
right.
for all of it to sort of click. And I think that without that additional kind of credit, you know, added credibility, I think he would have thought I was crazy.
Right. Amazing. So you open a delicatessen. First of all, what is a delicatessen? Because that word has become so applied to so many different things. The Korean deli on the corner, which I've never even understand the origin of that use of the word. But what do you think a delicatessen means?
Well, I think somewhat literally, it's sort of a store of fine foods. But to me, a delicatessen is defined by its smell. And if you walk into any form of deli, you know, in New York City, there, like you said, is a deli on every block. But a real delicatessen you walk into and you smell steaming meats. Uh-huh. And to me, that's always been my, you know, the defining moment.
That's so interesting.
To determine what's a deli in the sort of Korean corner deli sense, and what's a real delicatessen.
Wow. You're reminding me when we launched The Ment Chef, my Jewish book, my friend was the chef at Cafe Boulou, and we did a Sunday brunch for the book party at Cafe Boulou, and they uncovered all the onions and the salmon, whatever, and I walked in and I said, it just smells so Jewish in here. It's just amazing. With such a funny juxtaposition on the Upper East Side. So Mile End is I think really a fascinating place, because it's a place that resonates with the flavors and the stories, and even that idea that there's a grandfather somewhere who may be judging what's going on there. And yet it's also a very modern part of the Brooklyn food movement. I mean, if there is a movement, but certainly the thing happening in Brooklyn that we're in the midst of here ourselves. And so I wonder how you negotiate the old and new, the traditional and the future, the kosher, the non-kosher, which is a whole other conversation. I mean, I've heard you talk about it a little. I just wonder if you could explain to people listening what the zeitgeist is of Mile End.
Well, I don't negotiate the kind of dichotomy of the sort of old nostalgia and the new particularly well. I'll start by saying I think I'm somewhat weak at that. I've been battling opinions personal experience since we've opened. Battling is maybe a strong word, but you know, it's been a constant struggle to serve the food that I want to serve, that I feel is right to be served in the context of a Jewish deli opening in 2010.
Right.
All the while maintaining a customer base that is interested from past experience, while also inviting non-deli goers into the front door to also enjoy kind of a classic delicatessen experience. So, it's a very, very difficult question. I mean, the opinions of the sort of old guard, those that remember what it was like to go to Katz's with their father, or what it was like to, you know, sit at the Second Avenue Deli that was on Second Avenue and eat halushkas there. You can't deny someone their memories. You can't deny right. someone their experiences. I think, you know, what we try to do is just create food that is delicious at fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And my hope is that those people will come in and recognize that what they're experiencing is not that moment at Katz's or that moment at Second Avenue Deli, but what they're experiencing is this moment at Mile End with this delicious food. Now, serving delicious food is obviously always our goal, but every now and then there's a tough sandwich that goes out, or it's lean and they wanted fatty, or it's, you know, or the chicken soup is a little salty for them or not salty enough. That happens, and you know, we deal with it like I think any restaurant deals with an unhappy customer. But sometimes it runs a little bit deeper at the deli because there's almost a personal offense to it. Everyone believes that their deli experiences and their subjective understanding of what a real deli is, an authentic deli, is truth, and it is right. truth to them, but it's not necessarily truth to me or truth right. to the next guy. And I think that if we understood that and recognized that a little bit more across the sort of experiential spectrum of deli goers, I think, you know, it would be a little easier to deal with some of those difficult customers.
And if you're one of those difficult customers listening, we're going to take a quick break, think about that, and we're going to come back with Taste Matters. We're talking to Noah Burnimoff of Mile End.
You're listening to Kill Me in the Summertime by the Dead Stars on Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you.
Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hadeka. After visiting Christy's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn. They found a number of purposes for the slate and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. They now make regular trips to the family quarry in upstate New York to hand-pick their favorite pieces of black and red slate. Some of the slate is sourced from the quarry graveyard, a collection of odd-shaped pieces that were ultimately destined to be ground for use as road cover or baseball diamonds. They then transport the pieces to their studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn, where they do additional cutting and clean the stone to be food slate. Every single piece of packaging that comes with their products, from the envelope to the burlap bag, can be repurposed for other uses. The end result is a product completely unique in cut, shape, color, and overall presentation. For more information and to order, visit brooklynslate.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with Noah Burnimoff of Mile End Delicatessen. Do you use any Brooklyn slate in your restaurant?
We do, actually.
You do?
Yeah, we use. We serve our deli board on Brooklyn slate, black slate boards.
Well, there you go. And after hearing that commercial, I think I'm going to get some and use it as a home plate again or something.
Beautiful. Baseball.
Yeah, they are very beautiful. We have a question from a listener who wants to know, for those of us who aren't regular deli goers or who didn't grow up with the experience, what's the one thing we should be sure to order on a menu when we go to a new deli for the first time? Interesting.
Well, I think every deli probably prides itself most centrally on whether it's pastrami or smoked meat. We make smoked meat. We also do make a little bit of pastrami, but all the delis that I know that have opened up in the last few years, kind of, you know, concurrently with us, you know, the thing that they've all worked really hard on and that they spend most of their money on is the pastrami sandwich, more than corned beef and more than, you know, braised brisket or more than any other thing that they make. The thing that takes the most effort, the thing that takes the most money and the most skill is to kind of create that perfect, simple pastrami on rye with mustard.
Mm. Can you take us on a little taxonomy of those meats, just in case people listening, the difference between corned beef, smoked meat, pastrami?
Sure. So corned beef is brined in a salt and sugar-based solution with some other spices and herbs. It's usually brined for about 7 to 14 days, depending on who's doing it and, you know, what method. And then corned beef gets boiled or braised and then lightly steamed and served. Pastrami gets that same wet brine bath, but it gets pulled out and it gets sort of cures with a bunch of different spices separately out in the open, and then that gets smoked. Mm-hmm. And then smoked meat, which is what we make the most of, it's our most popular thing at Mile End, is never sees the water bath. So it's cured with salt and sugar and spices for 12 days in a dry environment. And then we smoke it for 16 hours and steam it. So essentially the three meats get the same kind of finishing touches at the end. They should all be steamed and hand sliced. But it's primarily the curing slash brining process and whether it gets smoked or boiled, braised.
Mm-hmm. And beyond that, I mean, we talked a little bit about this. At Mile End, certainly, you've fleshed out the menu with all sorts of Jewishy seeming things, and even lately, special Chinese menus on Sunday nights, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So, you know, I started the program by saying, you know, by telling the listeners, you know, that I was really inspired by the sort of loss of my grandmother. And it was that cooking that made me, that brought me closer to my tradition, my culture. And you know, deli occupies one slice of Jewish, you know, food culture. But there are other slices, including the appetizing shop, which, you know, very recently is getting some attention because Russ and Daughters just, Mark Fetterman put out a great book, the House That Herring Built, and it's just a great, you know, great stories about Russ and Daughters and running that business. And so you have the appetizing shops. You also have the dairy shops. You have the dairy kind of canon, which are blintzes and potato soup and kind of the things that could never, you know, occupy any space in a deli just because of the kashrut laws of not mixing milk and meat. And then you also have this entire world of kind of holiday cooking, home cooking, the Manch Chef, and before that, the Joe Nathan Cooking in America kind of, you know, that kind of world.
Very generous of you to put me in that trajectory, well, but thank you. Yeah.
I mean, it's the truth. But so anyway, so at Mile End, we wanted to at least capture a little bit more than just that slice of deli that we think is central and important. So those dishes that we serve at the deli in the evening on most evenings, I hope capture some of that, some of the sort of the richness and the love that goes into the home cooking with a kind of upgrade of technique and ingredients that we can provide as a restaurant staffed with, you know, really great chefs and cooks. So that's one reason why we do that. The Chinese food thing is it's totally quirky. It's not meant to be an authentic representation of Chinese culture. My family, if there was one thing that was, if there's one food group that could be called almost traditional Jewish food, beyond traditional Ashkenazi or Sephardi food, to me, it's Chinese food. Uh-huh. My family lived near a number of very Americanized Cantonese Chinese restaurants, and it was our tradition to go to those restaurants once a week on Sunday evenings. And while I have this great memory of my Nana Lee, which is my maternal grandmother who cooked cooked the Ashkenazi food, I also have a very strong memory of my paternal grandmother, Bubby Mildred, who would take us for Cantonese chow mein and tell me that the roast pork was just dark-looking chicken. So, you know, on Friday night, I went to Nana Lee's and I had that, you know, really Jewish experience in a more, you know, standard sense. And then on Sunday nights, I would have, you know, so my weeks were, you know, equally filled with beautiful Jewish food and very sweet, very sugary, Americanized, quote unquote, Chinese food. And so I felt like the past 3 years we've done Christmas because sure. Christmas is, you know, no one goes out to eat on Christmas except for Jews.
Right.
And
go to Chinese restaurants.
And they go to Chinese restaurants. Right. And I said, well, I can't lose the business on Christmas. So, you know, why don't we serve some Chinese food? And so we started cooking. We started doing Christmas Eve and Christmas Day the first 2 years that we were open through Christmas, and they were huge successes. This past year, we added a third day because the 2 days of seatings filled up so quickly. And I decided, what would be more traditional than serving, you know, inauthentic Chinese food at Mile End on Sunday evenings.
To me,
that's as authentically Jewish and part of my personal tradition as, you know, as eating kasha varnishka, as eating eggs and bacon in the morning on certain mornings, as eating bagels and lox,
right,
and as eating Chinese food. So to me, it's all wrapped into this sort of, like, you know, this American Jewish experience that I think. I mean, I don't know a single, I don't know a single Jew that doesn't like Chinese food. I've never met that person.
Well, we're not related, but we had the same life, clearly, years apart and separated by two Canadian cities in another place. But it's funny because last week we happened to have Nama Sheffi on the show, who is a great ambassador and a really creative thinking food person who integrates Israeli food into all these sorts of Jewish things. And it's so different, and it's such a different tradition, except for the fact that the kosher part is sometimes ancillary. it's almost unrecognizable to us, to this, these traditions. And yet that's also experiencing an explosion. I think here in New York, there's lots of restaurants and bakeries and coffee shops that are, that some direct from Israel and some just operated by Israelis. And to me, it's always funny to walk in there and not resonate in that way with those, that culture, those traditions, even though I love that they're Israeli restaurants, they seem Mediterranean or something very different. Do you think there's a similarity to the movement, or it's just coincidence that those things are happening at the same time, what you're doing, what some of the other Delhi people and people of your generation, the Gefilteria, those folks who've been on the show also, and the Israeli thing happening at this moment? Is there...
I think New York right now is a very fertile place for food. And so I think there's, you know, if you're going to capture anyone's attention with your food product, now is the time, I think, to put it out there, because there's so much attention.
Right.
You know, I don't think I could speak to the connection necessarily with the Israeli stuff, but I definitely think the Gefilteria is just an, you know, it's a furthering of the idea. You know, when we opened Mile End, we were opening a smoked meat shop. That was the kind of the, that that's the core, that was the central concept when we started. And I think, you know, that's not particularly different from what the Gefilteria is doing, which is, you know, they made this decision, they're going to explore, analyze, and recreate sort of a perfect version of a food that is being made very poorly and is being lost. And so, right. I think that's, you know, I think there's definitely a big connection between like the Gefilteria and the right. deli revival that we're seeing around the country with a number of different delis. You know, I don't know about the Israeli sure. thing. I will say that I've been to Bread's Bakery, uh-huh. and that rugelach is to die for.
And the babka is pretty special. but to your point, just to bring it back, because I think it's very interesting, almost what's going on with Jewish food is more similar to what's going on, say, with Korean food and David Chang, and with Italian food and the Terese experience, that a sort of third generation reimagining of these flavors and memories and experiences that these different groups had, and almost in some ways a celebration of them and a contemporization of them to the benefit of all of us, actually. It's really a great time now to eat these things.
And I think it goes, you know, taking it back just a step to like the idea of memory, it's, you know, because there is no single truth when it comes to the memory of taste and the memory of experiencing these foods in the past, you know, I think what, you know, and thank you for positioning, you know, the Jewish revival among, you know, the greats like Chang and Terese and Carbone. And, you know, I think what they've done is they've said, okay, well, you all have all of your truths and I can't change that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to present a new truth. And you could take it or leave it, but at least it can stand on its own as being an objective representation of the food. And I think that's what we're seeing now. It's sort of like this post, you know, it's a postmodern problem of not really knowing how to take a step forward when there's so many different avenues. And I think, you know, by just choosing a unique one, you don't have to be necessarily a large part of the past conversation. You can start a new conversation moving forward.
Fantastic. And what an interesting conversation it's been. We didn't get a chance to talk about your book, but a lot of your thinking and you capture a lot of sort of the sense of what we're talking about in the Mile End Cookbook, which is a great book, and I'd encourage everyone to order it. And also tell everyone that we're going to be together with some of the people we've talked about at the James Beard House on March 26th for a second night Seder. You can find out more about it at jamesbeard.org, but it'll be a real snapshot of a lot of the things we're talking about. It won't be kosher for starters, but it will be a representation, I think, of some of the flavors and memories and fun of the culture that we're putting together. So try to join us for that. Next week, we are going to be talking about a different tradition. It's funny, it's tradition month or year here at Taste Matters, with a group of Southern chefs who are part of the Atlanta Food and Wine Festival and who are trying to claim their Southern roots across the South in all different sorts of ways. And it'll be a fascinating conversation, I'm sure. In the meantime, Order yourself a big, thick, juicy deli sandwich and think about what it means. You're listening to Taste Matters.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.